to tell her mother Joe Hughes is one no good man.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Joe Retar Hughes, Gone Fishing. Born on this day in 1937, he worked with B.B. King, T-Boone Walker, and some of the greats in the blues world. So, little Joe Guitar Hughes. We are joined here in studio by Marshall Bell, who is host of Midday Magazine with Marshall Bell, managing partner with the Bell Group, LLC, author of Baltimore Blues, Harm City, just won election to the
Democratic State Censor Committee.
I had that right. I want to make sure I had it right. Dr. Raymond Winbush is back in studio. Director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC, co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, and a co-host here on The Mark Steiner Show. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We're going to talk about this Sun report that came out about police brutality. It was really a fairly thorough report. Really, they did a great job on this one, I thought. And we're going to talk about that with our guests. But let me get their reactions to something else before we jump into that particular piece. I was just kind of surfing the web on Sunday and found these new things that came out that come from some of the more far-right conservative media or conservative media. But this is, let me just read some of the headlines and get our guests' reactions to some of these headlines to start with. And your reactions as well at 410-319-8888. So we have this one journal that says evidence now emerges that Michelle Obama never gave birth to Malia and Sasha. Where are those baby pictures? And so that was one of the first things I read. Other was that former Congressman Alan West is encouraging the military to disobey the commander-in-chief because he's allowing people who are undocumented to serve in the United States Armed Forces. Then we have, was Michelle Obama a sperm donor to a surrogate mother? Ask Give Us Liberty, 1776 website. Why no birth records, just like dad or purported offspring of baby Sotero? What is the real father of Sasha and Malia? Who is the real mother? Are the Obamas ever going to come clean? And then another website, and a number of these keep doing this over and over again, saying Michelle Obama is a man posing as a woman. And a transvestite. When I read these things, at first, you know, you want to laugh. But Ray Winbush, in some levels, it's almost too scary to laugh.
Well, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have said that a person that was a former vice presidential candidate would give the address of the White House. It's 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue, but last week Sarah Palin did it. So I mean, the dumbing down of America that was predicted in the 70s.
I missed that one. I don't know how I missed that one.
Oh, yeah, she did. She said it publicly, too. Wow. So, you know, the dumbing down of America that was predicted back in the late 1970s has happened. And unfortunately, it's happened to politicians. It's happened to people like the ones you just read. I don't dismiss these people, Mark, as I used to, because what I'm seeing is that they're rising to positions of power like a Ted Cruz and others who feed and throw red meat at the right wing and to kind of fulfill their racial paranoid fantasies about black people and particularly the president of the United States. You know, I always say that, you know, white people don't make good minorities, especially when their boss is black. And I think that part of this stuff that, like you just read, is a reflection of that.
Marshall?
Well, you know, my thoughts on it, Alan West, we'll take that aside, but as far as these rumors whatnot, I look at them more like a litmus test, really. I like that they're out there in the public domain because, like you said, Ray, it does provide an opportunity for us to see how the so-called established political establishment, your established Republicans primarily, how they deal with them. Are they going to embrace it or are they going to reject it? It gives us an opportunity to see where you stand. You know, are you going to feed into that kind of nonsense? Let's get you on record. Do you believe this or do you not believe this? Some of them are bold. Some of them try to massage it. Some of them try to avoid even talking about it. But we know what's in their heart. But the question is, what do you really believe in? And I think it's a good opportunity. I don't have a problem with them, you know, because there's always going to be crazy stuff out there. But, of course, in this 24-hour news cycle that we have with all these different websites and all these, you know, blah, everybody has an opinion. There's all kind of crazy stuff out there. But it's okay. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. But the question is, what do the established elected politicians have to say about them? Are you going to run from it? Are you going to reject it? Are you going to embrace it? Or are you going to try to be real slick and try to not even deal with it? And that, in that case, we know exactly how you really feel.
Mm-hmm. For me, I do take it more personal, actually. I'm not even at the macro level of thinking about this in terms of politics, but as a woman of color who oftentimes serves as the brunt of many jokes regarding how her body is characterized in media, it says a lot to me about how we are still talking about black women and our ability to dehumanize them in many ways and at the same time attempt to dismiss them. So when we think about it, for instance, in terms of my own research, when we're talking about the black body, oftentimes we look at the black body as being this space that occupies a position of being revered and reviled all at the same time. And so when you look at someone like Michelle Obama, she occupies that space constantly, where many of us revere her as being, you know, this positive reflection of what a black woman or a woman of the 21st century is like as a mom and a professional woman. So we revere her for those particular standards, but at the same time, we're very comfortable to revile her largely based on her body. And those are where the attacks are often targeted towards her, is about her body, her arms, her buttocks, any part of her body that we can dissect and talk about to denigrate her instead of seeing her as a whole person. So I take it very personally.
Yeah, I mean, I was making light of it in a sense at the top of the hour, but on the other hand, it's very serious because what it is emblematic of a piece of what we're going to talk about here on the program as well. A study that I've not finished really looking at completely that another friend sent me that was a pretty stunning study on how we look at young. It's called The Essence of Innocence, Consequences of Dehumanizing Black Children. And it's an amazing report. I actually want to get deep into this report. I only had a chance to kind of read the first few pages and kind of run through it. I just got it early this morning when I first saw it, and I sent it out to you all like at 4 o'clock this morning, I think, when I was reading it. But I want you all to see it. But because it is part and parcel of the kind of unconscious, subconscious power that moves us in this nation because of our history and who we are, where the studies they did showed how they look at young black boys especially and see them as not children, mm-hmm. but see them as more responsible for actions, that they're already grown, mm-hmm. or compare them to the kind of ape-like features that this report says some people see. And I think that some of this has really come to the fore because we do have a black president that has raised the contradictions that would not have been raised otherwise, I think. Not as publicly. I think, and that's what we're witnessing. I think, but it's important, I think, because this is allowing, I think, society to wrestle with things the way they wouldn't have wrestled with them without this.
Yeah, but are we really wrestling with them? I think we're still running away from it, you know. And the problem is that, as the article suggests, it has very real, it manifests itself in very real ways. It manifests itself in the way the police officer approaches that 14 or 15-year-old boy, keyword is boy. It manifests itself in the way the judge and jury views that person, or even before that, how the district attorney decides to charge that individual as either an adult or as a child. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, study after study has shown that children's brains do not fully develop until they're, I believe, what, 23, 24, 25 years old. But when we view the young boy, we see, oh, he was culpable. He knew what he was doing. When we see the young white child, oh, he was troubled. We find excuses. He was troubled. That's how he's portrayed in the media. He was a troubled young child. He had extenuating circumstances. He's worthy of compassion in how he is charged, how he's approached by the police, how he's charged by the DA, and how it's adjudicated in the courts by the judge and juries. And then, of course, how he is sentenced. So it has very real manifestations. And as an African-American man, I got to share this with my sons. I have two 19-year-old sons. I got to let them know you're going to be viewed differently. Every day you walk out the door, you're going to be viewed, and you're going to have to take personal responsibility. They're going to make you take personal responsibility for any of your actions. I know that you're young. I know that you're not mature. I know you are. You know, you're my sons. But you're going to have to man up earlier because they're going to make you man up. And any mistake you make, you're going to have to pay, you know, dearly for.
I think the other thing is that, you know, I try to look at this in a context of not only the United States, but globally. I mean, Tom Burrell in his book Brainwashed says about the 500-year campaign to dehumanize black bodies in general, black women, black, you know, Sarah Bartman, mm-hmm. Saartje Bartman. I mean, this is not something new. No. The black body as object and the black body not as a child, but as a miniature adult is very, very old. I mean, we see this in, I think it's Jan Pieterse, he's a Dutch anthropologist who looks at the pictures of African people from, I mean, like 1400 and something all the way up to the present, and you see the black body as object, little black Sambo, Aunt Jemima. We still, you know, use to sell white products with black bodies as well. So, seeing black boys, we're doing some research at the Institute now. We're looking at how Michael Brown's story was portrayed in white media, and it's supposed to black media tended to call him a boy,
right,
whereas white media tended to call him a man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to me, he was a boy.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And but media doesn't want to see black boys as white boys. They want to see them as men or miniature adults or potentially violent people.
So what I got from the study, because I'm very fascinated with this topic, and you know, in my personal life, I've decided to found a charter school that is specifically for boys. And interestingly enough, the age range that we're talking about that we decided to start with is this particular space and age. So the study talks about how there seems to be this general understanding of embracing the innocence of children of all races and ethnicities up until about the age of 9 or 10. And then there is this major shift in terms of how we start to look at black boys at that time. And I think Dr. Wimbush is accurate that we've been dealing with this issue for a long time. So it's not this 2014 study that they have broken some new ground for us, because we can even in the late 20th century, we can talk about Dr. Jawanza Kunjufu and all of his research on black boys, and in particular linked to education, where he argues the point that this whole notion of the fourth grade failure syndrome, that something happens around the age of 9 to 10 in our fourth grade year for black boys in particular. And he makes the stance of two things in particular happening. He says, first, there's this shift in terms of what is happening with black boys and their interest in school, because it's no longer cool, right, to be the smartest in the classroom. So you start to act out, or you start to do whatever the behaviors are that make you cool in the classroom. But at the same time, what we also see happening is there's a shift in the adults who are interacting with these boys. And so that 80+% I think it's 87% of public school teachers are white, right, middle-class women.
Right.
All of a sudden, the shift in terms of how they look at that child is very different. And they engage him very differently. They don't engage him as the sweet, innocent child that he is. And now all of a sudden we look at him as being a menace to society. So now I engage you that way. And then there's so much media that also affirms that same position that it gives even more credence to how we choose to treat young black boys.
So, I mean, this kind of leads in some ways to the Sun article that I would like to kind of us to wrestle with here. Because there's so many things I want to talk about, so I don't get to all of them. I mean, the whole Viola Davis and Shonda Rhimes controversy that's taking place, that we can fit that in, weave this in, we will. But if not later in the week, this is also the 75th anniversary of Gone with the Wind. So there's all kinds of things we can talk about in terms of the media and culture that's coming up this week, which I hope we will be doing. But when you look at this report, that this investigative piece, the amount of money given out, $5.7 million, altogether when you look at the money spent on defending the cities, closer to $12 million being spent to defend the city and being paid out. You read some of the stories, the issues around this. I mean, and you know, this is something that you really I'm curious your reaction to this as soon as you read it. I mean, none of us, I think, were shocked by reading the report.
No.
Not something we didn't expect to happen. But I think it is shocking for people who don't experience it, who haven't seen it, to see this on the front pages of the paper. And to look at these pictures, when you look at the names and see how many, by the way, the names were women, not men.
That's right.
Who were beaten by police. Which is, you know, I mean, that could be, because we don't pay much attention to that. Right. The media doesn't, right, as mm-hmm. much as you do the men.
That's right.
So what are your initial thoughts and analysis of what you read?
Again, you know, I read the article in The Sun. I mean, I rarely commend the Baltimore Sun for anything. But in this instance, I do, because it's probably the most thorough study that we've seen in the past. I mean, I can't remember another study that actually examined it person by person, money and everything like that. I think, again, you know, that I think that white America, and particularly white cops, see black people as less than.
Black cops, too.
Well, yeah. I'm about to throw that in there. White and black cops. Yeah. I always feel like I got to qualify. Not all white cops, not all black cops, but the majority. I mean, there's books that are actually written about how they see a black woman, how they see a black man, and it's less than a white male or a white female. Marshall said it earlier. Kimberly said it as well, that, you know, what I don't get, to be honest with you, is that if I know I have a police force like our mayor knows that is brutal, like they do in New York, L.A., any city, in the major city in this country that has a high black population, they actually are allocating money for lawsuits, mm-hmm. which are taking away, as the article pointed out, it could build a rec center.
Right.
It could fund schools up to a partial degree that are doing something more positive. And people tolerate this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I make a habit. I got to say this real quick. I get calls from the FOP to ask for donations. They'll say, I'm from the FOP. I say, I don't donate to white cops. And nobody, they said, why not? And then I hang up the phone. I think that we've got to be aggressive in dealing with these issues about black policing as well as white policing of our communities.
But I mean, but to push on this a little bit, though, I mean, a lot of the police we've mentioned here who did the abusive were not all white police. They were black and white police.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. When you look across the globe, they're thinking about how we opened the show with the Metropolitan Police of London being founded on this day in 1829. That police are about power and protecting property and protecting the Inner Harbor, in our case in Baltimore, and other places like that. Mm-hmm. You know, when the young man who was killed by the gang members on the corner of Paca and Saratoga mm-hmm. the other day, mm-hmm. Who was being held as a shield mm-hmm. as the gunfire began, right. Young guys, people say, doing what he's supposed to be doing, going to school, working at a job, getting ready to marry the mother of his child, that's a level of containment going up there. It's to mm-hmm. keep people away from getting down to Utah. They cannot get down as far as Howard Street.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They, being the young black people on those corners, mm-hmm. cannot be allowed down. So there's something going on here. I think it's, what kind of conversation do we have to begin having now about containing this kind of power and reversing the power and giving communities more say in what's going on and more oversight? I mean, this is, how do we get there?
Well, it's a long discussion. It's a deep discussion. But let's be very clear, because we did mention this. We touched on this a second ago. It's not just white cops. It's black cops. Mm-hmm. It's just not white people. It's black people who view black people as less than. All right. And it comes from it's a long history of painting black folks a certain way. Okay. So to reverse this is going to take a lot. Okay. It's not going to happen overnight. But like you just mentioned, the question is, what do we do now? Where do we go from here now? I think it provides an opportunity for the mayor, for the city council, to take some leadership on this issue and say, you know, we're going to do it differently here. We understand there's a problem, okay? Most folks knew there was a problem anyway. Anecdotally, everybody knows that cops will beat you in the head, okay? But are they going to do something now about it?
We have to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to hear what people think. 410-319-8888. Eric, you're the first caller. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie. They performed the Carnegie Hall on this day in 1947. On this day in history, we're here with Dr. Ray Wimbush, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, and Marshall Bell, and you at 410-319-8888. We had a really rip-roaring discussion here during the break, which we're going to come back to on this. Let me go to the phones first and get people in here, and then we'll come right back. 410-319-8888. Eric, you're on the air.
Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Eric.
Very good topic this morning. I wanted to ask your panelists their opinion on something. Something that I get an indication that's systemic in the Baltimore City public school systems in the elementary and middle school is that the schools have this behavior chart, and it's in a descending color code where green means you had a good day, yellow means you didn't have a good day, red means you had an awful day, and then there's orange, and I'm not sure what that indicates. But the behavior that I see from the parents where they really berate their children if they don't succeed in getting green is very disturbing to me. And I was wondering if any of your panelists has come across any studies or any research that would really knock down that type of chart being disseminated throughout the Baltimore City school system.
Real quick, you know, I had said in my book Warrior Method years ago that tracking was a result of integration. Tracking became like an outgrowth of integration after Brown v. Board. And I'm opposed to tracking, but it happens in a variety of ways. I remember when I was a kid, it was the red birds, yellow birds, and blue bird. I was in a red bird. I don't know what that meant, but it wasn't a good group. And I think that's these subtle tracking is the way that Baltimore City and parents respond to tracking, too. I think it's just here to stay, and nobody's going to get rid of it. It's unfortunate, but it's just here.
Yeah, I concur, but I also think it's important to know that this isn't systemic to Baltimore City public schools. I mean, this is very much a public school phenomenon that we have began this process of really adding a layer of how important behavior is, and it does impact what we then think about our children. I mean, it's so interesting how all of these topics are very much interwoven into that very basic foundation of how we understand children and how we see them as whether they are innocent or not. I mean, so it's very consistent and tied to all of that, where if we already question and buy into a system that brown children or black children are going to be problems in the classroom, then instituting a system that then tracks how they behave not only impacts them directly in that particular classroom, but it then impacts them throughout their career, because teachers talk and the file moves along with the child and says, oh, be prepared for little Johnny and what he's going to do in your classroom.
On the way back to the phones, and Kim and Jane and the other callers, we're going to get to your calls. I just want to throw this out to you all first. I mean, coming back to this report in the Sun, they mentioned the Internal Affairs Report, which we talked about on the show here last week, that was done by the woman who's the executive director of the Sheriff's Association, saying it's in shambles, that there's systemic issues, that they do not follow up on complaints, that there is no real investigation. There are issues around here where the article talked about how the state puts a cap on the damages that people can sue the police for. And I think that should be on the table for people to talk about. Should there be a cap until there is something straightened out? There is a clause that says that these people who are in this newspaper cannot talk about what happened to them. Right. I mean, there are all these things that kind of silence.
It protects the cop. Right.
Yeah.
It protects the system.
Protects the system, right,
exactly.
And, you know, and there's a Policeman Officer's Bill of Rights, and I've read that several times. And originally that was put in there to prevent supervisors from firing policemen they didn't like. But now it's become a tool to protect cops who do things like what happened to these people in this report. So what breaks that open? What begins to change that process? We've given a lot of lip service to it. Commissioner Batson's program has said it never looks good when a policeman uses a baton or punches somebody. My question would be, do you ever really have That would be an that should be an extreme case of police behavior, not a daily case of police behavior.
The philosophy has to change. I mean, it starts with leadership, and it starts with training. You know, we talked in the break about, you mentioned Ray, your suggestion that, and I'm gonna tell you, I'm gonna get this, but you suggested that police officers should be college educated. Now I'm gonna tell you honestly, there are people with racist feelings who have college degrees, just like there are with high school degrees. And my other problem with that is that it will probably exclude a lot of potential black candidates as well. All right, you know, because often we're not as educated as white candidates. It's hard enough to get black cops anyway, or black applicants anyway. So that would be another layer to keep them out. But I don't think that's the end all. But I do think that once a cop, or at least in their when they're in training to become an officer, that should be an important critical component of their training is quote unquote sensitivity training, whatever terminology you want to use, to learn how to deal with the public. And let me say this, last thing I'll say, when we talk about schools, it's the same phenomena in schools. I've recently spent time in a middle school, and I was noticing how some of the teachers, and a lot of them are white female teachers, like we were talking about, how they talk to the students. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like they're in a prison, line up against the wall. I was walking through, I was like, wow, you know. And just the way they were talking to them, as if they were like little, this is a prison. And that's how they were talking to these young black boys and girls. And it was stunning to me that this is how they're talking to, you know, 11 and 12-year-old children. But they have the same thing. They come into their workplace the same way police officers come into the workplace with all the mess that they've internalized their entire lives about how you look at black people.
So, go ahead, Kim.
I was just going to add that, you know, the situation with LeVar Jones in South Carolina couldn't have happened if the police officer didn't have a particular preoccupation with how he viewed black bodies. That a young man, regardless of what you personally think about him, but a young man that gets out of his car and then is asked to retrieve his license and turns around to do so and then gets shot.
Right.
Says a lot about what we are thinking about individuals. And so I agree with Marshall that it's so important for training to be a part of this conversation, but it has to be at a deeper level. I mean, it's similar to anything that we do even in our workplace, where if you're working for a corporation, there's always this sensitivity training and this session that everyone has to participate in, which is absolute BS.
I can say that part, right? It's BS.
And so I think
wait for consultants to make money and do nothing.
Right. And I think in some ways that's why Dr. Wimbush's perspective about college educated adds some credence to this conversation, because then there is a longevity to the messages that are being transmitted to students for them to understand the role of the rest of us on this earth and how we have to learn to get along. I'm not saying that's the only avenue, but I think that there's a deeper level of training that needs to take place other than this Pollyanna, let's sit here and get through this session today to talk about race.
Let me get a bunch of calls here in a row so people can get their voice out and we can respond, okay? 410-319-8888. Kim, you're on the air. Hi, Kim, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Oh, I know this voice. Hi, Kim Trueheart. How are you?
I know this voice, too.
How are you, Kim?
How are you?
I'm well,
hey,
Kim.
Good. Wonderful discussion, for sure. And, you know, one of the things that I've been discussing in my own little circle is that we have a need for one of these independent review boards, but it needs to be comprised of civilians and lawyers and school teachers and doctors, because there's a sense of unreasonableness that occurs in this police department in Baltimore. Right now, they will write a report, in my instance, where I was arrested at City Hall, that says that I resisted and I was combative. And you know, how do you say those sorts of things about people and then it be condoned by management and acceptable in a police report? There's this culture that needs to change rapidly, and I'm not sure that we have the will to change it. Right. This mayor has made the statement that she wants to study whether or not we're going to have cameras on our police. That doesn't make sense. We don't need to study this.
Kim,
I mean,
Hey, Kim, did you know that Baltimore actually has a police review board that is absolutely impotent? It's impotent.
It's toothless.
I mean, it does nothing. One guy has been on there for like 600 years or something like that, and nobody pays attention to it. The problem is that the existing systems for dealing with what you say aren't working. And the mayor doesn't seem to be caring about that. All police officers should wear cameras. I mean, that should be part of just like they wear guns. It should be automatic. And if there's, it goes off at a certain time at a critical point, that officer should be investigated.
Right. I think what Kim raises here is really kind of critical issues. I mean, I'm looking at these. I'm going to read some of the things that happened to some of these people here, and many of these who were women and elderly women and women who actually called the police for help.
That's right.
To be found themselves to be smashed to the ground and had their handcuffs put on them. One an 87-year-old grandmother. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Jane in Baltimore.
Hi. Thank you. I am a Caucasian 50-year-old female, and I agree with for the most part with what everyone is saying. I have empathy for the black community that is clearly disproportionately mistreated, but I just wanted to add my story. A couple of years ago I was taking pictures of there was had been a pedestrian hit, and they had been taken away, and so there was no problem going on. But there was a couple of policemen there, and I was just taking pictures, and the guy got really harsh with me and said I had to move, and I said I wasn't doing anything wrong, and he and he was, I think he was Hispanic, I don't know, but he ended up taking my belongings, throwing them in the trash can, and really roughly handcuffing me. I had really bad bruises, grabbing my arm, did not read me my rights. So I guess what I'm saying is, it's a real problem, a systemic problem in our police force. I realize that it affects black people much more, but just that what I went through was really horrific, and I just want to share that with you.
Jane, thanks so much for your call. Let's get one more in here, then we'll come back, and we'll get you all in here today, by the way, at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Jim in Annapolis. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I have started a project called the Nanny Helen Burris Project, which talks about her views and visions. And on Saturday, with my fraternity at the Murray McLeod Bethune House, we studied, I had a book review of Carter G. Woodson's and the Miseducation of the Negro. Basically, what we concluded was that we need to concentrate on what it is that we can do and stop blaming other people for our problems. We felt that we need to teach our children how to think, not what to think. For example, recently I understand there was a city ordinance passed which banned sagging pants. And you know what sagging is spelled backwards. And one civil rights organization there in your city challenged this in the courts because they called it profiling. Well, we need to concentrate on how to teach our children the right thing to do. And we need to have that discussion among ourselves first so that we can focus it into the wider community. And I would ask that people would look at the project called the Nanny Helen Burris Project to see what she said about the future of America. As Frederick Douglass said, it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Jim.
I got to respond very quickly. You know, I've always said about this whole thing about sagging is that if all young black males stopped sagging, would that stop police brutality against them? No. Dr. King was killed in a suit. So was Malcolm X. And so I know some of the old folk, but we did stuff in the day. You know, I wouldn't wear platform shoes. My parents didn't like them, but I wore them anyway. You know, so I think that it's almost like if we can magically change black people somehow the society will get better. And I think I just challenge all of that. I think the brother's doing good work, but you know, think about this stuff deeper than that. What we're really talking about is how do we change people's attitudes towards black folk?
Well, I think that I'm gonna comment on what you just said too. But let me just kind of read some of these things that were in the paper. Star Brown won a settlement because two officers threw her to the ground and beat her. And she was an accountant and pregnant, called police to report an assault. Venus Green, 87 years old, called the police to say her grandson had been shot. They didn't believe her. They said she lied, that he was shot in the house. They forced her way in the house, threw her down, broke her shoulder. And she died 6 weeks later, but they said nothing to do with that. But who knows whether it has something to do with that.
And trauma.
Jonathan Hunt, who had his leg and collar broken over a traffic stop. I mean, the question is, and I asked this question of Commissioner Batts, I asked this question of State's Attorney Bernstein and others, and of the head of the FOP, what is excessive force? How do we define it? No one can give me a definition of what excessive force is. Is it necessary? Picking up people and slamming them to the ground. Is that what we have to do in order to arrest somebody?
Well, the thing is, they get a lot of latitude in that regard. I mean, and the thing is, judges and they look at, they believe police officers first and foremost, all right? And any justification they give. Let me just say this very quickly. Nothing's going to change until the pain is great enough, all right? Until the pain of paying these payouts is great enough. We talk about the expense that the mayor is bucking as far as putting on the cameras on officers. The question is that if that expense can alleviate the pain of all these cases that are being settled, perhaps you consider. You understand what I'm saying? That until this hurts enough and a real and pain and the shame. Now that's our job as people in the media to shame the police and expose this. And I'm glad that son did this, as well as the pain of paying out this money. It's not until it's great enough, nothing's going to change, because you're dealing with dollars and cents here. And like you said, they work it into their budget. We accept that so many cops are going to beat people's butts every year, and we're going to have to pay out this money. Mm-hmm. And it's ridiculous.
But I think that we need to have, it seems to me that somehow conversation has to be had mm-hmm. about the notion of power and race, both independently and together, what that means. I mean, how many elders are on this list? Mm-hmm. One is a friend of mine on this list. I just noticed his name there, James Clay, the barber, who is one of the real elders of this community, thrown to the ground, had his arm broken over a traffic stop. Yeah. And even if he was disagreeing with the police officer, you don't take a man with a thin man with a beard who's posing no threat and break his arm.
You do if you have a certain image of that person,
right.
Though, Mark.
Right.
And that's the key. Based on how we look at one another really impacts what we then decide to do in advancing that interaction. And
right.
So if I see him as a threat, then I am prepared to use whatever force is necessary to contain him.
But also, if I know that I'll be backed up by my police department.
That's right.
There's no fear of me doing what I feel I have to do. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, the public may look at it differently, but if he knows that his superiors are going to try to cover it up or hide it, you know, and he knows that his attorneys and lawyers are going to protect him every step of the way, and then also that it will never be exposed.
And the mayor,
okay.
The combination of power and race are powerful here, and I'm going to come back to those. I remember the one time, one of the times I was arrested. That
just one.
Did you get your rights? Were your rights read to you, by the way?
Before Miranda, right?
Wow.
I mean, I was in handcuffs, held in the air by legs and arms, and I kept saying I surrendered, but I was beaten to a pulp. despite there's no reason to be having done that to me, but that's what happens every day to people in Baltimore. There's no reason to beat the people you have in your custody. They are arrested. Take them to jail and book them. Most of them shouldn't be arrested in the first place, but, I mean, this is how we have to address this. I think that there has to be a real kind of open discussion and laws passed that will end this kind of behavior so the police can do what they're supposed to, which is protect the people, if they would do that.
Protect and serve.
410-319-8888. A lot of people calling in. Let's go now to who's been holding on a while. I think Leonard, you're on the air. Leonard, you're on the air. Welcome. Line five. Not there? All right, let's go. Leonard, you there?
Oh, this is Christopher Irvin. How are you, Mark?
Okay.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Dr. Wimbush, it's been a while.
How you
Mark,
doing, bro?
Really quick, I'll suggest tea with honey and lemon.
That's me, you hear coffee. Thank you.
The one thing that I would say really quickly is throughout the conversation I've heard, and I understand this, we're talking about the image of the people who are being assaulted. And what I would challenge people to do is to let's address the image of the police. We are not holding the police to their own standard. Mm-hmm. The police should, we always give this caveat that not all police are bad. And I understand it. I've done it myself. But now, in my opinion, and what I'm beginning to do is to change that. No more caveats. All police are bad in my mind. When you approach me as a police officer, you should be cognizant of that, and you should prove that you are not that officer. Address me properly. I should respect that officer properly. And they should have to be mindful that that imagery is out there and prove every day when they put their uniform on that they are not that officer. When we give caveats, we give passes, and we allow for those who are that officer. And I think that that's where a lot of the problem begins.
Chris, I agree. You know, but it's rare that police see themselves as a problem. They don't see themselves as a problem. Yeah. This guy, the Ferguson police chief, the other day did that stupid apology, if you want to even call it that, and then walked through the crowd. The most important dialogue was not what he was saying to Michael Brown's parents, but what he was saying to the people afterwards, if you listen to that stuff. I don't think cops get it sometimes, and I agree with you. I think the cops should go into their job saying, these people basically don't like me, they don't trust me. I rarely hear cops say that. I was on a panel a couple of weeks ago at Fisk University with a cop, and he just didn't get it. Yeah. And everybody in the audience did, but he just didn't get it.
But you don't have to when you're operating from a position of power.
That's true.
And you're also in the position of privilege.
That's right.
And so we are not as the citizens, and so we then have that burden to prove versus police officers.
The question is that communicated in their training that with such power comes great responsibility? And that's the real question, because
ask politicians that question, and we know the answer.
I mean, you know, when you see the police officer with the video, and he beats outside the bar, it's just straight beating him up, and we know why he did that. But he did that because he has a badge,
right.
He has a gun, and he has his boys with him, and he knows that unless that camera was there, he would have gotten away with it.
Send him to college.
I don't know. That's gonna help.
I'm not so sure. Sending the college is going to change the nature of daily patrolling and what they do. I think that, you've got to, even these cameras will be great, but they're not going to resolve the issue. Mm. The issue resolves when you have things in place that address the questions of power of the police and what can happen.
Checks.
When you have people have, whether it's on the neighborhood level, as Heber Brown says, whether it's a citywide level, where you have an organization that actually has the power to look at these cases, judge them, and say, yes, send it to the state's attorney for prosecution, no, whatever that would be, that you need to have a group that has power, subpoena power, the power to kind of bring all the records up, to have people investigated, to cross-examine. We don't have that.
And unless it's an independent body, that won't work either.
It has to be an independent body.
Because otherwise, you still are in the same cycle of politics that then say, but if we do this, what does it communicate? And what does it then say about our legitimacy of power? And so even in that instance, we get the same results time and time again. So an independent body is the only way to have something like that.
And there continues to be pushback on the city and the executive, that they don't want to give that kind of power to a civilian review board.
Exactly.
Right. And nobody has the courage on the council to push
that, because they want to get the FOP vote,
exactly.
And all of that.
Right.
It's systematic.
So who has the will to do it? That's the question.
The FOP vote, very few of the police live in the city. They're not going to get a vote anyway.
Yeah. Well, right. That's true, too.
Pardon me. I'm sorry. 410-319-8888. Call an hour or wait. Take a caller now. Yes, ma'am. Leonard, you're on the air. Line four. Hi, Leonard, you're on the air. Line four, you there? All right, let's go to Ray in Columbia.
Yes, Mark. I'd like to expound on a topic I tried to broach before when I called, and that's us needing a methodology for Black life in America. Power concedes nothing without a struggle. And we all know that. I mean, these guys who are police chiefs, heads of this and that, they work their whole lives to get to where they are. And we need to understand that once we threaten their power, we can make change. But to continue to yuck it up and wait for someone else to do it, we've got all kinds of black organizations, but it doesn't appear that we're working together. There needs to be some place, you know, where we can go, someone who's accepting a repository of black crimes in the state of Maryland, the city of Baltimore, so that we can go after certain police chiefs, so that we can tell our children, this is how the system works. Because if you don't know how to play the game, you're going to constantly lose. So, you know, you just can't tell a kid, you know, once, well, go out to vote. And then all of a sudden, you know, well, you didn't vote. When they don't know what it means to go out to vote, they don't understand what change they're expecting to make with their vote. This needs to be built upon, and we need to send it down to our children and their children, and we all need to know how to exact change in America. You know, you get some leaders that, you know, I'm one of those, I always call myself a tweener. You know, I'm 50-some years old. I was brought up in the late 60s, early 70s, where when you pass somebody on the street, you say, what's up, brother? And that meant something. You know, that the era when James Brown came out with the marching song of Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and that meant something. But then those leaders who were in the struggle, they got theirs and forgot about us.
Rabbi, I'll take a quick break. I'm going to come back and talk about what you just said. Not talk about you, but what you just said and wrestle with what you just said. 410-319-8888. Daryl and Alan will come to your calls as well. We'll be right back. Stay with us, please. It's year 1980, Curtis Blow, The Breaks, comes out. Here we are. Here we are, here in the studio here with Marshall Bell, Dr. Ray Wimbush, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, and you at 410-319-8888. And you all want to respond to our last caller? We get to our next... about getting our young black children ready for what they have to face in this.
Parents do that anyway. I mean, if you're parenting.
I think he was thinking on a more macro level that we're doing something as entities instead of at the micro level, because I think you're right that we're all doing that as parents.
Well, I agree, yeah. That's absolutely needed. I mean, I agree with them. But, like, again, I'll say, as I prepare my two sons for life, I taught them life lessons, not just with dealing with girls, not with just dealing, stay in school, but dealing with the world around them, that, you know, you are viewed by many people as less than, as an enemy. But we all had this. I know we all had this conversation with our parents that you have to do better twice as well as your white counterpart. I had to, you know, here we are in 2014, and we're still having these same conversations with our young people, you know.
You know, it's like what Derek Bell says in Faces of the Bottom of the Well. See, I think the racism, as you know, Mark, I think it's permanently embedded in the society. Mm. I think it's permanent. I think we can kick against it. I think we can do that. But what happens when you're in a system that's permanent, you start turning on yourself for solutions. You say, well, if the system won't budge, I'll budge myself. And that doesn't work either. And what we've got to do is realize that this stuff is global, it's all over the planet, and we've got to kick against it, but we've got to deal with systems. And we don't do that a lot.
Kind of where you and I kind of separate a little bit, because I do understand that philosophy. See, here's my thing. The system, like you just said, is terminally corrupted and sick. That's how I view the system, okay?
Right.
You're right. Racism is deeply embedded in this culture, in this country. The question is, how are we as African American people going to navigate through the system? Now, I'm not saying that we sell out, I'm not saying that we compromise ourselves, but the reality is that we have to survive, we have to eat, we have to live, and we have to build institutions, all right? That's how, that's to me, and it's not, you know, to change a system that's been here for 400 years. I don't, maybe because I don't come out of that 60s tradition.
But Dr. King did
because
it.
Because y'all tried.
He did it.
Well, he tried, and he made movements towards changing it, but he didn't change the money. That's really the basis of this system. the point I'm making is that we have to learn how to live in this system and to be successful in this
live
system.
In the swamp. I can't do that.
Well, then we need to leave the swamp then, because the swamp is going to be the swamp.
Hey, I ain't got no problems.
Say that to Ray Wimbush.
Don't say that.
I'm just saying.
Not say that to Ray Wimbush.
Bags packed and ready to go.
Give me two.
We're in the belly of the beast, brother. We got to figure out how we're going to live and survive and succeed in this.
But I'm going to go back to phones here. But the other part of that, though, let me push back a little bit, is that when you especially talk about King and Malcolm in the 60s, that is where I came from, and Ray
too.
As well, right? Maybe a few years younger than me, but he was here as well. Because it is not a matter of changing things. Things, as a friend of mine said who just passed away, Michael Brand, whose son played basketball here at Morgan State University, he said, you can struggle for 50 years and never see change, but you fight against it. And then all of a sudden, you're going to see 50 years of change like that overnight.
That's right. That's right.
And that's what it's about. It's pushing, never stopping, because it's a constant struggle. It didn't end with the abolitionist struggle. Didn't end with the struggle against segregation.
Right.
It's not going to end with the struggle we're having now.
And I mean, I'm not disagreeing with it. I believe that you're right.
That's how...
Right.
You know,
we keep pushing, but at the same time, we have to do some realistic things to navigate through the system. That's all I'm saying. Don't shake your head. I'm saying we do.
Hey,
but we keep fighting. We definitely keep... I'm not saying we don't keep fighting. I think everybody has a role in this in making things better and different. I understand that. We keep fighting. But in the meanwhile, we got brothers dying on the streets. We got people that can't get jobs and can't eat. We have very real day-to-day issues that people need help with, man. That's all I'm saying.
But I guess
I agree with that, but that doesn't mean that we... It's like saying, I'm going to live in the swamp, and I'm going to stay in the swamp, and we got to deal with the swamp. We do, but we have to look at alternatives to the swamp as well.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
I guess, you know, part of it is, obviously, and where Ray and I sometimes differ on some things, which is all right, which is that I think it's also deeply embedded, but I think it can be changed. I think we are changing it in some way. And I think that, you know, when you see I guess part of it also is I think that when we look at a city like Baltimore, people only see this as a black problem. And I say it's not a black issue.
It's a white issue.
It's a human, it's a societal issue.
Right.
It's a societal issue. It's an issue of dealing with race that's deeply embedded, racism is deeply embedded in the system that we have to root out and not shy away from rooting it out. I think that having these conversations openly about what people perceive about what somebody is because they are African American and being stopped by the police has to be addressed over and over and over again until you begin to root it out. You can't just let it slide.
Right. No,
you know, this article may bring it up, but then it's up to the people not to let it slide.
I agree.
Right?
Right.
Let me see what folks think of 410-319-8888. Let's go to Daryl. You're on the air.
Go on, Mark.
Good morning, Daryl.
And to your guests as well. I'm so glad that this conversation is ongoing. Being a resident of Baltimore City, growing up in the projects, it's always been believed that Baltimore City police officers or department had this them against us mentality. So when they come to work in the morning, it's we have to protect ourselves instead of them. We have to protect ourselves from them versus them, you know, protecting us as citizens. So I think they had, you know, this cowboyish kind of mentality coming into the neighborhood. They had to, you know, deal with different things, especially when the drug epidemic took part, you know, this cowboy, you know, the seizure that they are binded by directing, you know, arrest, it just went out the window. No matter how it took to get this problem solved, we were going to do it. And there was no protocol to the things that they were doing as far as, you know, arresting people. So I remember growing up as a child, you know, a police officer used to come to the school. Whatever happened to Officer Friendly? What did he retire?
Came about Officer Unfriendly.
Having Officer Friendly. Officer Friendly used to come to the school and the kids were raising.
I remember Officer Friendly.
Oh, Officer Friendly is in the building now, but he's there. trying to contain and make sure that children are behaving appropriately.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What have we come to? We have to have policemen walk in the halls.
I know. Yeah.
Even in elementary schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. It's we have gotten to a point. I think we need society needs to rethink about pulling back on some of the things that Daryl is talking about here. Yeah. Let's get one more call in. We'll get some thoughts from you before we have to move on to another subject. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Alan on line 3. You're on the air.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Very well, Alan. Welcome.
Very good.
I'd like to talk a little bit about an organization called the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. It was initiated by Cornel West and Carl Dick, and they're calling for a month of resistance in October, which is just around the corner, and October 22nd, and they're calling for people to build an organization that will stop this mass incarceration and to change things. And so I don't know if you have a way to get in touch with them, but they're listed online as Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And I'd like to also say that briefly that this police culture has influenced even private security guards. I was stopped by a security guard at a bar named Cowboys and Rednecks because I was parking my car, and he ran out to the car, and they stood in front of my car, and they said, "Oh, we need you to exit your car." And they started talking all like cops, and they wouldn't have done that years ago if not this cop mentality about just being able to stop people and force them out of their cars. Forced them out hadn't been popularized. And the last quote I want to say is Lee Horst Zemper said, "Change will come when those who have nothing to lose realize they have nothing to lose."
Alan, thanks so much for your call. I just think that closing out from all your very different perspectives here about what needs to be pushed and how we need to push it in this community. The conversation has to be had. We were hoping the mayor's office was going to call in today. They said they might do that. And we hope they will come on soon to talk about this. Mm-hmm. Some very concrete steps that have to be taken. We're looking for Commissioner Batts to come back on as well. But very concrete steps that can be taken that may not end it tomorrow morning, but at least begin to address the issue that people face in this community. When I look at these faces, the people on this website who have been beaten and just, you know, and feeling their pain in terms of their fear. Mm-hmm. You know, it's overwhelming.
We shouldn't have to live like this.
No, people should not have to live like this.
That's right.
Well, you should be cooperating with the police to make your neighborhood safe, not having fear of police. You're going to be beaten up because you called because something's wrong in your neighborhood.
That's right. They have to be viewed as partners. Look, in the end, it's going to take the political will of our leaders. It's going to take the will of the people to put the fire to the feet of our so-called leaders, from the chief executive, the mayor, to the city council, to institute changes that are going to make a difference. And the question is, are we all willing to get into this fight and see it out to the very end? That's the question.
And from my perspective, I think that's very important as well. But even more at the forefront for me is what we talked about seeing change in this 50-year period, and it doesn't look like there's movement. But I also think we need to project and think about what the future is for the generations behind. And there's a tendency for us to focus on present day and what all of us are encountering as adults. But again, just going back to the earlier conversation about this whole idea of the essence of innocence among Black children, that there needs to be conversations about what we are doing now with the children that are in our public schools and how we're engaging them, how we're interacting with them, what images are we projecting onto their bodies that then allow us to see them as many adults that we then, as once they enter into adulthood, we act upon. And so it's very important for us not to just seem so fixated on present day, but we need to think about what work are we laying down now as a foundation for what will happen for the generations to come.
Ray Wimbush.
Well, I agree with Kimberly. I mean, seven generations, like, you know, First Nations people say, we've got to think for the future. And if we don't, we're going to be doomed, as Malcolm said, to make the same mistakes of the past.
Dr. Raymond Winbush, who is director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC and co-editor of Black Berries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Black Body Politics in Africana Communities, and a co-host and substitute host on this program, Kevin Harris. Oh, no, he didn't show up. Kevin, it's the mayor's office. Marshall Bell.
Yes, sir.
Not that he didn't show up. They wrote to us saying they were going to try to call in. Marshall Bell, host of Midday Magazine and OLB, managing partner of the Bell Group LLC, and author of Baltimore Blues, Harm City.
Yes, sir.
Good to have the three of you with us. Thank you
Thank
so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to wrestle with another difficult subject, the Islamic State. Stay with us. Whew.